chapter 3, and we got down, I think, to about verse 6. We'll kind of pick up there this morning. You remember now the people that Cyrus, king of Persia, in the first year of his reign, made an edict allowing the Jews who were in exile there to return to Jerusalem, those who had a heart to do so. And some 50,000, roughly, give or take, returned with Zerubbabel, who was named governor of the area. There are different levels when you read through Ezra, and as well as in the books of Kings, there are different levels of governance in these provinces, and so they overlap, and it's kind of hard to keep them straight. But he was in charge of the group that were allowed to go back to Jerusalem. With him was Jeshua. Haggai refers to him as Joshua, the same person, and so they go back to and in chapter 2, I believe it was, and verse 1, we see that when they went back to Jerusalem, it says, each to his own town. And so the people, as they returned, would naturally kind of go back. Most of them had not been alive. Some few would have been alive. We'll make comment about that later. But their own town, in the sense they would have known where their parents had lived and so forth, and they would naturally make their way back there and begin to make arrangements for living in Jerusalem again, all that would entail. Some, I'm sure, mainly the Levites, but some others as well, would have gone to Jerusalem, and later on we're going to see efforts made to bring even more people into the city of Jerusalem. They needed more people to make sure that all that needed to be done could be done. But anyway, so they first went back to the towns, and then on the first day of the seventh month. Now, we talked last week, we don't know when they left. We know when Ezra, we're going to read about beginning in chapter 7, he left in the first month of the year. And it took him 4 months. He tells us how long it took to go. How long it took these people when they left, we don't know. But assuming, and that's an assumption only, that they too left in the first month, and if they could have gotten there as quickly, which is doubtful, that so many people, they would have gotten there in the fourth, fifth, or sixth month. So they hadn't been there long is the point. So they hadn't been there long, but on the first day of the seventh month, they all assembled as one person. Now, the reason for that is, in the meantime, they had built an altar there in Jerusalem. They had, in going through the rubble where the city had been destroyed, apparently they had been able to recognize the where the altar actually had been placed. And so they cleaned the debris away and built this altar on the exact spot where the original altar had been built. And everything was in readiness, so the first day of the seventh month they came together. And we talked about last week the seventh month was the most sacred month of the year to these people. All of these things, not only the sacrifices relating to the new moon, but also the first day of the seventh month was a day of solemn rest that was occasioned by the blowing of trumpets and all these kinds of activities. And then the 10th day of that month is the Day of Atonement. And then beginning on the 5th day, the Feast of Tabernacles, which lasted 7 days. So a lot, and that's to say nothing about the daily sacrifice, morning and evening, that went on. So a lot was going, and it seems like that Zerubbabel and Jeshua were of the opinion, okay, now we can't stay here any longer without restoring the service of the altar. And so they built the altar, and on the first day of the seventh month they came together. And in verse 6, we see that they began offering on that day what the daily sacrifice. This is a reference to the sacrifice in the morning and in the evening. And so from the first day of the seventh month, we're reading in verse 6 of chapter 3, from the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, but the foundation of the temple of the Lord was not yet laid. So their main purpose in coming back, the reason why Cyrus had proclaimed that edict was to give them the opportunity to come back and rebuild the temple. And he took personal interest in that. We're going to see later on that that he even recommended, I guess maybe is the word, the dimensions that would be, and they were somewhat different from the dimensions of the temple that Solomon had built. And but he took a personal interest in it and mentioned some of the materials that were to be used, stone and wood, and how that they were to be used, three rows of stones and wood and all that sort of thing. So they had not yet begun doing what he had sent them back, allowed them to come back to do. So having observed these, having started the sacrifices again, and we're also told that they observed, starting on the 15th day, the Feast of Tabernacles, which lasted 7 days. I think I've already said that, haven't I? And all of the sacrifices that were required each of those 7 days. So when all of that was through, they still hadn't begun building the temple, and it was time to do that. So in verse 7, they gave money to the masons and the carpenters and food and drink and oil to the Sidonians and Tyrians to bring cedar trees from Lebanon to the sea, to Joppa, according to the grant that they had from Cyrus the king. Now, you may remember, harking back to Solomon's temple that he built, he had all kinds of help. Money running out of his ears, and his father had, he was not allowed to build the temple, but he had begun to make preparations, collecting materials and money and so forth, and making an agreement with Hiram, king of Tyre, and you know, about wood and all. But so they do have this edict from Cyrus and his grant that basically is going to be paid for out of the treasury. But still, there was work to be done, and they would have had among them that returned some men experienced in mason work and carpentry, because like when they had been in Egypt and they had to work in Egypt, I'm certain that they were employed in Babylon by the government to do various things. So there would have been some masons and some carpenters. And so they were identified, and they were called out, and they were paid with cash, with money. But then reference is made to the Sidonians. It seems that Zerubbabel had an agreement with, of course it wouldn't be Hiram, that centuries earlier, but with the people from Tyre and Sidon to provide forest. And if you can read something about the forest, especially back in those days, it's not today anything like it was then, but they had great cedar trees. I guess in some ways it would be kind of like those trees we have in California. I don't mean in size, but how well they were appreciated and so forth. But the agreement was that these men would fell the trees and get them down to the sea, Mediterranean Sea, and maybe they did that by letting them float down streams and rivers, kind of like you've seen that done in Alaska. They cut them and put them in rivers, and they'd float down. And then when they'd get to the sea, they would build rafts or just have a bunch of logs together and float them down to Joppa. And then the Israelites would come over to Joppa about 35 miles and somehow or another get them across land to Jerusalem. So all of those arrangements were being made, started soon after the time when they met on the first day of the seventh month. Okay, so then verse 9, let's see, verse 8. Now in the second year after their coming to the house of God, of course it hadn't been built yet, but to the place where it would be, where it had been, after coming to the house of God at Jerusalem in the second month. Now, the second year, doesn't mean they've been there a whole year, but in the second year after they arrived, and in the second month of that year, this was the month Zif, Z-I-F, and it was called the month of blossoms. So the winter has passed, and so the people have made ready. By the way, it corresponds with our month of May. Interestingly, in the second month, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Josedek, made a beginning together with the rest of the kinsmen and the priests and the Levites and all who had come to Jerusalem from the captivity. They appointed the Levites from 20 years of old and upward to supervise the work of the house of the Lord. Interestingly, as I started to say a while ago, this was done on the first day of the month of Sivan. This was the same day, what else had happened? When Solomon began to build the temple, his temple. Coincidental? I hardly think so. But you remember, we've already seen several things they'd done. When they built the altar, they were careful to build it on the same spot for the other. And so it may be that Solomon wanted to start the rebuilding of this temple on the same day. We don't know that for sure, but it just makes you wonder, doesn't it? And so they appointed the Levites primarily where you say, well, why? They're different. In the Old Testament, you'll read of different ages that people from the tribe of Levi were called to do various tasks. And much of the time, they were older than 20 years of age. And so why were they dipping down to 20-year-olds on this occasion? Well, if you remember back to chapter 2, the numbering of those who came, there were only 74 Levites who came. Well, in addition to that, there were 128 singers who were from the sons of Asaph. They were Levites. And 139 doorkeepers, so all added together, there's about 430-something. Still not a whole bunch of people. And they were primarily given the responsibility of building the house. And Jeshua, with his sons and his brothers and Kadmiel and his sons and the sons of Judah together, supervised the workmen in the house of God, along with the sons of Henadad and the Levites, their sons and brothers. Verse 10, and when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, I think the sense of this is as they began to lay the foundation. This is something somewhat similar to a groundbreaking that we might have, but it has more spiritual aspects to it than a groundbreaking would have. And so when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests in their investments came forward with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord according to the directions of David the king. In the book of Exodus, if you go back and read when God was telling them how they were to make these vestments for the priests, you remember that Moses said, for beauty and for glory. And we've talked about before how that all of that involved in the investments for the priests and the building of the tabernacle and all of that highlighted aspects of God's character, nothing more than His holiness. And so, oh, and also you remember, where was it? Back in chapter 2, we learned that one of the things that the people gave were what? 100 priestly garments. And so perhaps some of those that they wore on this day were some of those that had been made and given to them. In verse 11, they sang responsively. This is the second time that I can recall, maybe more, in the Old Testament, where we read that in the singing there was a responsive or kind of a back and forth. In Isaiah chapter 6, when the angelic host around the throne of God is singing, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory. The scholars, Hebrew scholars, tell us that that was very likely a responsive type singing. The one angel would say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts." Another would say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts." And they perhaps would join together in saying, "The whole earth is full of His glory." But here, definitely, they sang responsively, and their singing had to do with praising and giving thanks to the Lord. And there is a quotation here that suggests that possibly the psalm they were singing, or at least one of them, was Psalm 136, because he says they sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, and in quotations, "For He is good, for His steadfast love endures forever toward Israel." You may remember when we were studying Psalms in the last two semesters that I taught, one of the Psalms we studied was Psalm 136. And that psalm has 26 verses, and I've outrun my notes here. That psalm has 26 verses, and each verse ends with this expression, "For His mercies endure forever." It begins, "Oh, give thanks unto Jehovah, for He is good." That's what it says here, doesn't it? "For He is good, and His loving kindness endures forever." Verse 2 says, "Oh, give thanks to the God of gods, for His mercy endures forever." Verse 3 says, "Oh, give thanks to the Lord of lords, for His mercy endures forever." And it goes on and on. 26 verses, and all of them end with this expression, "And His mercy endures forever." So some have thought that perhaps that was the psalm that they were singing. Certainly it was that sentiment that they were expressing as they joined their voices in song. And then verse 12, "But many of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first house, wept with a loud voice when they saw the foundation of this house being laid, though many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the joyful shout from the sound of the people's weeping. For the people shouted with a great shout, and the sound was heard far away." Some of the older people who returned had been alive to see the temple before it was destroyed. Remember, the temple was destroyed in 586 B.C. The edict was given in 536 B.C., so that's just 50 years. Now, those like Daniel and his friends who were carried away during the reign of Jehoahaz, that was 70 years before. But some would have been old enough to have seen the first temple. And when they saw it, they cried. I don't know what it was about it. It may have just been a nostalgia. It may not, of course, it wasn't a temple at this point. In fact, it wasn't much in the way of a foundation even laid at this point. We're going to see that their neighbors were so disrupted, they didn't make a whole lot of progress for a long time. But something about it, maybe it was the stones. Maybe they were not as big. Maybe they were not as finely prepared or something. But I have a suspicion that a lot of it was just pure old nostalgia. You know, those of us as we get older, we tend to think that nothing is as good as what it used to be. Isn't that kind of the way we think about it? And so that probably was a big part of this. They just thought back on the temple and the fact that it was so beautiful and it had been destroyed, and it just made them feel badly. And then nothing they could see that helped their feelings a whole lot, because they didn't see a whole lot to give them the idea that this would anywhere be close to it. But anyway, a lot of these older people cried. But then there are the younger ones who had never seen the temple. who were glad just to be released from captivity and back in their homeland. And so a new start, a new day, and they shouted with joy. And the voices of the ones crying and the voices of the ones shouting for joy mingled together, and it says that they were heard from a long way away. Any questions or comments on this before we go into chapter 4? All right, let's read a little bit here in chapter 4. Now, when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the returned exiles were building a temple to the Lord, the God of Israel, they approached Zerubbabel and the heads of fathers' houses and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we worship your God as you do, and we have been sacrificing to him ever since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." Let's talk just a minute about these adversaries. These are the Samaritans. These are the people who lived in the area that once was the northern kingdom, where Samaria was its capital. You remember that the northern kingdom fell to Assyria in 722 B.C. And when it failed, those people who were still alive, a lot of them would have been killed as the armies marched through the land, taking city after city, before finally coming up against Samaria and laying siege to it. And after several years, it fell. So many of the ones who were alive, the majority of the ones who were alive, were taken away captive, and they were scattered out. 2 Kings 17 and verse 24 mentions the name of five or six places where they were put when they were taken into captivity. And it would have been taken a while. Sargon did. The Old Testament suggests that there were three different colonizations of Samaria after it fell. Sargon, after these captives were taken away, it would have taken a few years, some time at least, for him to bring... they would take people captive and then take people over here and bring them back over to where they had taken these captives. So it would have, finally, Sargon brought some people. In the meantime, 2 Kings 17 tells us something very interesting. When these people that he brought back into this area arrived, and they hadn't been there long, They reported the fact that wild animals were increasing among them. And it was still so part... we don't know how long it was, as I've already suggested, before people were brought in to join those that were left. A remnant was left. Not every single soul, of course, was taken. So there was some time, and during that time, without people to hunt and keep the wild animals, just multiplied and began to come into the cities and kill some of them. So these people that were brought back in there complained to the king and said, "Hey, we don't know the God." They were polytheists. They were, am I saying that right? They believed in many different kind gods of, you know, they believed that there was a God of the hill and God of the valley and a God of this and a God of that. And they thought, well, now what the problem is, we don't know the God that protects us from wild animals, and that's the reason we're being preyed upon. And so when they reported this to the king, what did he do? You remember? He sent a priest, one of the priests from Samaria that had been taken away, sent him back over there to teach the people. Now remember, you know who these people were that were taken away. They had become so idolatrous, they had so rebellious, so disobedient of God. And the priest, what did Jeroboam do when he took the 10 tribes and established that northern kingdom? He didn't use the Levites because they wouldn't have anything to do with his golden calves. You remember? The true priest. So what did he do? He just started appointing priests from among anybody. And so that would have been who came back. They didn't bring a pure religion. This priest then didn't bring a pure religion back with him. But he did teach them that's who these Samaritans are. There were three colonizations. Sargon, pretty soon after the destruction, brought in a group. And then a few years later, he brought in a contingent of Arabians, added to them. And then about 30 or 40 years after that, his grandson, Esarhaddon, that's the one that's mentioned here. So these people that approached Zerubbabel and Jeshua and asked to join with them, they were of that group. They identified with that last group that had been brought in, and that had been some 130 or 40 years before. That's how long even they had been in the land. So they asked. Now, they weren't possessed of good motives here. They probably had it in mind to disrupt, the progress, because that's certainly what they did after this. And when they said, we worship the God you do, well, after a fashion they did, but he was only one of many gods. In fact, interestingly, going back to 2 Kings chapter 17 again, if you keep reading, you'll read about this. And in chapter 17, verse 33, the writer says that they feared God and they worshiped their idols. But then in verse 34, it says they did not fear God. That seems to be a contradiction, but not really. All it meant was that they didn't. Their fear of God was only an external thing. It wasn't something that really came from the heart, and that it wasn't a true worship of God, because they also mixed it with idols and so forth. But anyway, this was the Samaritans that asked to join them. And so verse 3, we get the answer. But Zerubbabel, Jeshua, and the rest of the heads of the fathers' houses in Israel said to them, "You have nothing to do with us in building a house to our God, but we alone will build to the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us." So they were certainly wise in turning down this group. Then verse 4, "Then the people of the land discouraged the people of Judah and made them afraid to build." There were many ways they could have done that. They could have just threatened them, always aggravating them. They could have disrupted the supply chain. Have you heard that in recent years? Well, we're not the first to have I'm quite sure that they would do what they could to disrupt the delivery of the logs and the stones. And also, as King Cyrus has commanded, they would no doubt likely, because it says they bribed. Have I read that yet? No, that's in verse 5. But they bribed the authorities. So they probably tried to disrupt the payments as well. And so if they couldn't pay the people or couldn't pay them on a regular basis, it would be hard to keep a work. So there are many ways they could have, and no doubt did, disrupt them. But now in verse 5, we have a specific means mentioned. "And bribed counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia," of Darius, king of Persia. This, and in the last verse of this chapter, it gets more specific, and it says until the second year of the reign of Darius. Now, this is a period of time. This verse here speaks of a period of a time of about 14 to 16 years. The rest of Cyrus's reign, which was at least 5 years, some say 7 years. So let's count five. Keep in mind the seven. So the remaining 5 years of Cyrus' reign, and then his son Cambyses or Ahasuerus. He was known as Cambyses to the Greeks. He reigned for 7.5 years. And then a guy named Smerdis, who's referred to in history as pseudo Smerdis. He was a guy who usurped the throne under the guise of being the brother of Cambyses, and thus having a right to the throne, who had really been murdered. And so it took a while for the people to find this out, so he reigned 7 months and 2 weeks. And then following him would have been Darius, and so you'd have to count the first year of Darius. So in all 14 to 16 years, these people, by various means, disrupted the work. I don't think it means that it ended completely altogether. At times, they may have hit a lick here and a lick there, but they really didn't make a whole lot of progress there. So having kind of looked down the road and said, okay, they disrupted the work for 14 to 16 years during these people. Then, beginning in verse 6, he goes back and gives us a specific example of a major event that happened, a major way that they disrupted the work. And I want you to look at these next three verses, and I want to talk a little bit about them. In the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Jerusalem and Judah and Jerusalem. In the days of Artaxerxes, Bishlam and Mithridath and Tbeel and the rest of their associates wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia. The letter was written in Aramaic and translated. Verse 8, Rehum, the commander, and Shimshai, the scribe, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes, the king, as follows. Now, I want to comment about this a little bit. I don't want to get too deeply in the weeds, but I want to comment about this a little bit. These verses, in fact, the rest of this chapter, there's a lot of disagreement among commentators on this. Now, what am I talking about? I want to summarize this as quickly as I can, but give you a little bit of a feel for it. Well, are there three different letters mentioned here? There are some who think that verse 6 describes one letter, that was, it doesn't contain the letter, but just simply says it was an accusation. Then that they think that verse 7 describes yet another letter. This one was written in Aramaic and translated. And then in verse 8, they say there's still another letter mentioned, and this letter is recorded in this text. So there are some who think there were three letters. Then there are those who think there were but two letters. They think that verse 6 describes a separate letter, and it was written to Ahasuerus, who was otherwise known as Cambyses, but the son of Cyrus. But then they say that verses 7 and 8, these people, are two verses that describe the same letter, and that Bishlam and Mithridath and Tabiel and their associates were the instigators of that letter, but that letter was actually written by Rehum, the commander, and Shimshai, his scribe. They were more higher officials. And so the idea is that the people you read about in verse 7 kind of instigated this, and they may have, going back to verse 5, they may have bribed Rehum, but in some way or another they got this official to actually write the letter, you know, for them, and it went. And then these others just... Then there's another view. By the way, for a long time, I agree, Kyle, commentator Kyle takes that in the opening verses of his discussion of chapter 4, he takes the view of there being two letters and does, I think, a good job of defending that view, and just had me convinced, but you keep reading, and then he abandons that position in the latter part of his discussion of chapter 4, and he goes to yet another position that I'll describe in a minute, okay? I think that's the weaker position, the one he went to. But then there is the position of Matthew Henry. You probably are familiar if you look at commentary, the commentator, and he has a very interesting view. He says that there was only one letter. He says, let me explain to you what he says. He says that verse 6 gives us the purpose, the general purpose of the letter. It was a letter of accusation against the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And then he said, after that, the persons involved in writing the letter are mentioned. And so he says in verse 7, we have those who plotted or who instigated this whole affair. Then in verse 8, we have the ones who actually wrote the letter. That would be Rehum. And then in verse 9, we have the subscribers to the letter. In other words, the ones who assigned their names to it say, we concur with what this letter is saying, with this representation about the Jews. Really, it was a misrepresentation. That's one of the simplest ways of looking at it, and I have to admit, I tend a little bit to gravitate to that. That regardless, then the final position, the one that Cal goes through, and by the way, our own brother Burton Kaufman, a Texan who wrote commentaries in the 50s and 60s, and you probably familiar with Brother Kaufman's commentary. He takes this view that I'm about to describe, and I can't buy it. But who am I? That you read for yourself. But here's the view they take. See, verse 5 talks about a period of time in which they were disrupted in their work, and I've already talked about that. A period from Cyrus to the second year of Darius, about 14 or 16 years. And then he backs up, in my judgment, of a natural reading, and gives this one instant. But they believe, Kaufman and Kyle eventually came to the belief that what he does here, right in the middle of telling us about what was happening, in the time when they were trying to build the temple, that all of a sudden he goes off and starts explaining something that happened 80 years or more down the line. Because here's all their proof for it. Their reasoning for that, look at verse 12. Be it known to the king that the Jews who came up from you to us have gone to Jerusalem, and they are rebuilding that rebellious city. They are finishing the walls and preparing. So they think that this expression, those who came up from you to us, meant literally those people, you, and this is not Cyrus now because he's already dead. And so they say there weren't any more who came up after Cyrus until the time that Ezra came 80 years later. So they think that, and also they base it on Artaxerxes. This name, they say, usually refers to these kings that were living and reigning during the time of Esther. Few years, 80 or more years down the road. But most commentators say that Artaxerxes was a common name or title that was adopted by all the Persian kings after Cyrus. And I think this idea that having come to you is a weak idea. He doesn't mean that came from you, king, but from where you are. The people that came from there to us are about, and they said, building the walls. Well, raising this, first of all, it's just an exaggeration, which they would tend to do anyway, trying to get them in trouble. But oh man, I knew this was going to happen. But it can be explained. There had been no effort to build the wall, of course. But the people, when we get to Haggai a little bit later on, not only did they stop building the temple because of the adversaries, but the people Haggai will tell us that the people had become neglectful, and they started giving their attention more to the building of their own homes than building the temple. And he has to chide them and get them out of that frame of mind. But if you remember, what about Rahab? Where was her house built? On the wall, because she let the spies down over the wall. Lots of houses in Jerusalem were built. You know, one of the walls of the house would have been the wall of the city, you see. And so, no doubt, these people in rebuilding their houses and reestablishing themselves would in some locations be building little parts of the wall, but there was no way. So that's just a poor argument, in my opinion, for what it's worth. Now, you go and read and study. In my opinion, what's happening here, let's get back and read it right quick. In my opinion, these adversaries came and they managed to bring to a halt the building of the temple during this 14 to 16 year period. And this that we begin reading here in verses 10 and following, simply an example of a serious effort that was made that brought it. Have I spoken so quickly? Have I clouded your mind? All I want to know is there are different ideas here, but I don't think we all lose sight of the fact that in the first two verses, we're told that adversaries did all they could, and then we're given this specific example. And whoever the king was, I happen to think that Ahasuerus was the same as Cambyses. I think that Artaxerxes was the same as Ahasuerus, that we're just reading different names of the same person. And I tend to believe that there was either just one letter or at the most two letters, but that attempts were made in writing to the king through provincial leaders to get him to stop this. And they managed to do that for a while. And the next bell is going to ring just momentarily. But let's go as far as we can. Any questions about any of that before we go? I hope I haven't confused you rather than clear it up a little bit. Okay. So, I knew it. Okay. We'll read the letter next week and we'll make more progress. We'll get through this in the next chapter. But they're going to manage. Oh, look at verse 24. Then the work on the house of God in Jerusalem stopped. See, that just suggests to me that what we've read above that just led to the stopping of the building of the temple. Not the walls, but that nobody had started building the walls, but the temple. And so I think we just, no matter who the king was, whether it was Cambyses, whether it was Smerdis, who only reigned 7 months, some effort was made to get it stopped, and they were able, as we're going to see, to stop it temporarily until the second year of Darius. By the way, Cambyses, the son of Cyrus, was not well disposed toward the Jews as his father was. So he would not have done much. So it could very well have been him, because he would not have done much to help them. But Darius was one who, like Cyrus, favored the Jews, and we're going to see what he did to allow them. Okay? Well, we'll continue next week. Thank you.